This is a story about getting bad guys off the streets, people who commit assault and aren't held accountable for them. One of the reasons is the evidence hasn't been tested. It's a story that we've covered a long time. Hannah Scott has certainly been on this beat for a while. So we're talking about these backlogs of rape kits which have gone untested. Some of them have gone untested for decades. So where does it stand now?
So we've made some progress in some things that need to get done before we can get that backlog cleared in the last couple of months. One thing was just this month, the state finally got a tracking system online so victims can track their rape kits all the way through the entire process, starting at the hospital. That was a big thing that everyone wanted to get done. And then last month, with the help of a federal grant, Attorney General Bob Ferguson's Sexual Assault Kit Initiative team was finally able to get a statewide inventory of the number of old kits that are sitting on evidence shelves.
We did this inventory, and the result that we heard back from local law enforcement agencies is we have more than 6,000 of these kits that have not been sent in to be tested.
6,460 to be exact. The oldest one from 1982. Now, that doesn't count the 3,300 backlog kits that were submitted for testing, and of roughly which 1,100 or so are still waiting to be tested.
And what we're finding is when these kits do get submitted and are tested, that a significant percentage of them end up with a match to a national law enforcement database of convicted felons. So on so many levels, it's critical that we get these kits submitted for testing and also to get the state to test them at a more efficient rate.
Of the old kits that have been tested, more than 200 came back with hits or matches in the FBI's criminal DNA database that connect to another crime, some linked to cold cases, others to suspects who had reoffended during the time that that kit sat on the shelf.
Can I ask you, that's a breathtaking number, 6,460 kits from 1982. Does this mean there are 6,460 rapists running around, or are many of them likely already in jail?
I don't think that there's a clear understanding of that. There is some, you know, we're talking rapes that go back to 1982. Some of them, 200, have been linked to other criminals who are in that criminal database. Others are out there. So, you know, some of them could be repeat offenders. It's unclear at this point, but certainly a big deal for public safety. Ferguson's big takeaway from the inventory was that we needed to get this done as quick as possible.
We need more funds from the state legislature, and my office will very possibly apply for another grant once we've completed this work, because this will be a multi-year process to get this backlog processed, submitted, and tested.
Now, other states have already pulled that off. Just last month, Oregon cleared its backlog of about 5,000 rape kits that went untested. Kentucky has also cleared its. And Ohio's backlog, which we've talked about before, they cleared their 14,000 untested kits this year with the help of a new lab. It's a high throughput lab with better equipment, robots, and just more efficiencies, and they were able to get theirs cleared quickly. Now, that is essential for our state, which, in addition to the old tests that are still sitting on shelves, is also dealing with a growing backlog of new rape kits. Now, that's largely because of the sheer volume of kits coming in after a 2015 law in our state mandated that all new rape kits be submitted for testing, and because of older equipment and staffing shortages. Democratic State Rep. Tina Orwell, who heads a legislative sexual assault task force and has spearheaded the efforts to clear the backlog in our state, says with the inventory and tracking system now in place, she is going to focus on the turnaround time to get these tests done.
We really need to have clear goals around when all the older kits will be tested, as well as how rapidly we'll be testing new kits. Right now, it's taking 8 months to a year for when a new sexual assault kit comes in, and we know that's just too long. That's too long for the survivor to wait. That's too long to have a potentially very dangerous offender in our communities.
So she's putting the final touches on a comprehensive bill that's going to, among other things, include these timelines for testing those old kits and any new kits. And that will help the lab follow Ohio's lead to get a high throughput lab, figure out what resources they need to meet that timeline that the Ohio lab did, which was 25 days. State Patrol is already on that. I checked. They have a budget request for $6 million for the next 2 years to get the equipment that they need, as well as seven new staff members for DNA scientists to turn the Vancouver lab that we currently have, which has space, into one of those high throughput labs and turn around those rape kits as quickly as possible, eventually to 30 days. It would take a couple of years to get there, though.
So does this change crime rates in states where they have, like Ohio, where they've gone through and tested all these rape kits and arrested people?
Does it lower the crime rates? Yeah. I know in, I believe in Ohio, they were able to link again theirs to several hundred cold cases, lock up some criminals because of the testing that was eventually done and that DNA going into CODIS. I think in Detroit, where they've made some progress on their backlog, there was something like 700 people that were connected, but the prosecution, it still takes time. I still think we're talking about just dozens when we talk about prosecution, but these backlogs are clearing just recently, right? In the last year or so. So it's an ongoing process. I think eventually you will see more of that. And at the very least, get some closure for these survivors who, most of which had no idea that this horrible kit that they went through at the hospital was never even looked at and just sat on a shelf.
Right. Do people at least know that now? I mean, are you...
They do know that. Now, I think most people know that now because of all of the media attention that this has been getting. But, you know, this only came to light a couple of years ago. There was a lot of effort on a nationwide basis to bring attention to this. In fact, Representative Orwell will be at an event on Capitol Hill on December 9th, along with some others from the Attorney General's office, where they're going to be doing a viewing party of I Am Evidence. That's a really informative documentary on the rape kit backlog nationwide, which is estimated to be about 400,000 kits.
I Am Evidence?
I Am Evidence. Yep. You can find more information on how to get involved with that at MyNorthwest.com.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Many of you have been through this. I know I have. At some point, you realize that one or both of your parents are too old to drive. Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Well, of course, the first thing that the tips you off that you're old to drive is when they take the eye test and they can't pass. But, I mean, sometimes, I mean, for us, with my dad, it was taking one too many drives where it looked like he was about to hit something. And we decided it was too much. So what standards do you use?
Yeah, good morning, Dave. So this is actually a very sensitive topic for a lot of people because the truth of the matter is there is no one right answer. And it's not necessarily an age-related thing, although aging does play into it, but it's actually a safety-related thing. We do lose our skill sets. We lose our eyesight, our ability to hear well, our reflexes, and so forth as we get older. But not everybody loses them at the same rate. Not everybody ages at the same rate. And so it's hard to attach a specific number to it. And I think that's what makes this a very sensitive topic. The first thing to look out for is hearing or sight loss. I mean, these are important things in our ability to drive. Obviously, you have to be able to see the road, right, and you have to be able to hear road noise and hear horns honking and hear sirens and so forth. So, you know, as you lose your hearing and as you lose your sight, I mean, glasses and hearing aids can only do so much. So, you know, if you don't have these senses, I think it can be one of the first things to look for. If you start to notice minor dents in your parents' car or your loved one's car, minor dents are really an indication that they're having small crashes and they may not even be noticing that they're happening. These minor dents can really be kind of the warning sign that a more serious accident is on the way.
Are there things you can determine in a physical exam, like reaction time, for example?
I mean, there are tests for reaction time, but they're not really widely available. And do they necessarily translate into your ability to drive? I don't know that that's been done or not, but certainly they're not widely used. Of course, there are things like hearing tests and visual tests. And even now, the DMV makes you take a vision test, right, at the time of your licensing.
But have you ever found yourself with a patient who comes in for a physical saying, you know, based on what we saw today, sir, you probably shouldn't be driving?
That does happen. It doesn't happen in my field, but it does happen. I mean, when people have progressive neurological diseases or dementia or things like that, they can have their driver's license taken away. If people start to have what are called TIAs or transient ischemic attacks, which are kind of like a precursor to having an actual stroke, people can lose their driver's license for those things. In fact, if you have seizures, oftentimes you can't drive for a period of time until you're seizure-free. So, yeah, there are things that can happen that can result in the loss of a driving license. But I think really the question that we're talking about now are things that happen as you age. The real question is, you know, how old is too old to drive? And it's not specific. And I think there's just these things to watch out for. I mean, I think if you notice that your family member or your loved one is easily distracted, well, if they're easily distracted in a conversation with you, then they may be easily distracted while they're driving. you asked about reaction times, and it's a good question because, you know, do you see things when you're driving with them? Do they run red lights? Do they run stop signs? Do they fail to brake when an animal runs out in front of them? When they see things like this, you know, you really got to think and worry, like, what if that was a child? Could something happen? And so, you know, that's another warning sign. Again, if you notice poor driving techniques, you're noticing that they're not really just driving as well as they used to, and they're doing things that are unsafe, pulling out into intersections in an unsafe way, making a right turn into traffic in an unsafe way, whatever. Poor driving techniques, things that make you uncomfortable, those are, of course, a warning sign. And then if they're getting multiple tickets, not parking tickets, but moving violations,
yeah,
those are things that we really, off. Yeah, that's a tip off. And I think really what it all boils down to is if you're driving with them and your gut tells you they're not safe, then they probably aren't safe. And you probably need to have the conversation with them about whether they continue to drive.
Do you think there should be a strict age cutoff with pilots? I believe it's 65, right? 65 and you're out. Should there be something similar with driving?
I don't agree with a strict age cutoff. I mean, I think there are people who are 90 years old who drive quite well, and I think there are people who are in their 50s and they don't drive well at all. So I really do think it's an individualized thing, but I do think it's probably worthwhile beyond some given age, because the aging process happens to all of us, that we should probably be retesting people and see if they can pass an exam. But the thing is, you know, for elderly people, this is their independence. This is their way of getting around. This is their way of doing things. And they've had their car and they're often on fixed incomes, and it's difficult to say to them, oh, now Uber everywhere, because they may not have the financial resources to be able to do it. And they've got their car that they've had for 30 years and the car's running fine and they only drive it a few thousand miles a year. And so this is their independence.
Yeah. Of course, the one good thing about older drivers is they're not wedded to their devices. They can typically get through an entire trip without looking at the phone even once. Dr. Goren Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us is CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, looking at Wall Street, for people who are seeing themselves a flat since the beginning of the year and who are looking for some nice boring bank to put their money into at about, oh, maybe 2%, but at least it's guaranteed, is that a good idea at this point?
I mean, I'm not a market timer. I don't know where the next move of the market is going to be. And it's probably a good reminder to all of us that, you know, the recent volatility, the fact that we're in a correction in the major markets, down more than 10% from the recent high, that's just part of being an investor. And we always whine about it. But, you know, it happens from time to time. It actually even happened this past February. It's not like we need to go way, way back. I do think that if you need your money, right, if you know you need that money, it never should have been in a risky investment in the first place, so yank it out. But if you don't need your money, and chances are you don't, it's probably part of a retirement portfolio. Even if you're retiring in 5 minutes, you're going to need that money to last you for probably 20 years or so. Then you just don't do anything. You stick to your guns and you remind yourself, yes, it's scary, but I'm in this for the long term.
Okay, the trade war. We were talking about, I remember a year ago, whether this was really going to be a long-term thing or whether it was something that would scare China into complying, then it would be over. China's not going to cave anytime soon. So where does that stand now?
You know, it doesn't look like they're going to be changing. I guess that at this current level, where we are right now with the announced tariffs, it does not look like this is going to necessarily derail either of these economies. But, you know, I interviewed an economist last week on my podcast, and she said something quite interesting. She said, you know, she does a lot of surveys of big corporations, and that it's next year when it looks like about 20% of those corporations are going to pass along those price increases, those tariffs. They're going to pass them along to consumers. Now, why is that important? Because if all of a sudden prices are rising, not only is it eating into our bottom line, but it also kind of forces the Federal Reserve to act. And if the Fed starts to raise interest rates at a time when maybe the economy is slowing down some, that is actually a recipe for a recession. And a lot of people have said, oh boy, it's the Fed that causes recessions. This may be a case where the Fed doesn't really have a choice.
Now, explain that. Doesn't have a choice but to cause a recession?
Well, if prices are rising, right? the Fed has a tough is going to be in a tough position to not raise interest rates, right? Because if they keep interest rates too low, then we get what we had the last time around, which is a big asset bubble. And if they then raise rates as the economy is slowing down, it could further the slowdown. What the Fed is trying to sort of is not going to try to avoid a recession. It's going to try to time their rate increases such that they slow down the economy, but they don't tumble into a recession. So they want to slow it down without a full-blown contraction. It's just really hard to do that timing the right way. Many Federal Reserve officials have said it's just like we're making ourselves crazy trying to project the future. We've got to deal with what's here and now.
Looking at the big picture and thinking long-term, there was a New York Times piece on China. And it basically implied, anyway, that America has blown our lead. We spent our money fighting wars, whereas Chinese has spent its money investing strategically around the world and creating this huge trade network, which eventually will eclipse us. Is there something to worry about there?
I mean, you can worry about it, but you can worry about lots of things that you, over which you have no control. So I would say that that is a really accurate description, which is it's not just that we're fighting wars. It's just that our lack of attention to longer term goals is really going to hurt us. And so we can look at that with climate change, you know, with the government's own report that says it's going to shave the growth rate. You could look at that as not investing in your own infrastructure so that you have great cities that are booming like Seattle and New York, but they are essentially crippled because of a transit system that just doesn't work, or in the lack of affordable housing, so more people can't participate. So all those things that require our brains to think super long term, you know what? We haven't been great about that. And it's no doubt that China is going to become the largest economy in the world. I guess now the question is just how dominant will they be? Mm. We're just going to all have to live in different places. You know, New York is the new Miami or something like that.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you very much.
Take care.
It's time for our Sports Insider. Brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here, having survived his family Thanksgiving, is Danny O'Neill.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
You should feel great. Your Huskies won. Your Seahawks won.
It was fantastic.
Amazing.
You see, give me your exact reaction when the Huskies took the Apple Cup.
Well, honestly, my cousin was there, and my cousin goes to Washington State. So I didn't want to be too... I honestly didn't, because there's only one Coug whose nose I want to rub in it, and that's Jim Moore.
Okay.
So it was a good game, and I honestly, I feel this way, that it was, weather neutralizes and changes a lot of different things, and that probably, in that environment, wasn't the best forum to decide which of these two teams is best right now, but I was really happy. I was beaming on the inside.
And you called it. You said the snow would be a detriment to Wazoo.
Yes. And Washington was able to consistently run the ball. Because for years, that's what the knock was. The Huskies don't like it when it gets cold. The Huskies can't run in snow. And as the game conditions deteriorated, it was very evident how much that played to Washington's advantage. And they essentially kept running the same play over and over and over. Hand it to Gaskin or perhaps Savon Ahmed. Have them run left off tackle, make Washington State's cornerbacks tackle, and they couldn't do it. Not once the whole time. I did want Miles Gaskin to make a snow angel after he scored on the 80-yard run.
Well,
that was my big squeal of delight. I was like, do a snow angel!
And that's who it was. It was Gaskin, and this is, what, the fourth straight season he's run more than 1,000 yards?
Correct.
That I see?
Yeah, first player in conference history to do that. It's
impressive.
Awesome. He and Jake Browning and a whole host of other Husky players who are seniors will graduate, will leave Washington having never lost to Washington
That's
State.
Amazing.
Wonderful.
So this sets up a Pac-12 championship.
That's
run.
Correct.
Yeah.
We go face the dreaded Utes from the Pac-12 colony that is Utah. See, there's used to be the Pac-10, and then we expanded to include Colorado and Utah.
Right.
But I consider those more Pac-10 colonies than full-fledged Pac-12 members.
Yeah. Does it mean anything to win the Pac-12?
Yes!
Do you go somewhere?
Yes!
After that,
you go to the Rose Bowl, Dave!
Oh, you do, that's right.
Yeah.
Does the Rose Bowl mean anything?
Yes! The Rose Bowl is awesome!
That means you're
one
the best...
bowl that means something.
I love it. No, there's a lot of other ones.
So
but
it means
the
you're
Rose
the best team ever?
No. No, it means you get to go to the Rose Bowl, the oldest bowl game there is, and you get to go spend January 1st in Pasadena.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
Where does Washington State go?
Probably. No, they're not going to the Cheez-It Bowl. They're better than that. I would guess they probably end up in the Holiday Bowl.
We talked about the bowls on
Yeah, Cheez-It Bowl's played in Arizona.
And what was the Weed Killer Bowl?
That was an old one. The Poulan Weed Eater Bowl. Yeah, that's correct.
You don't want to go to that one.
No, probably somewhere in Louisiana where they deal with crabgrass.
That's for sure. Let's talk about the Seahawks. Boy, that was an exciting game.
It was unbelievable.
I was a little worried at the beginning, as usual, but no, that was a pretty exciting game. And now, what does their playoff scenario look like? I was supposed to root for Green Bay yesterday, right?
Yes, you were.
Which I did. Didn't work, though.
Dude, they're terrible to root for. They're absolutely a mess of a team. I feel bad for Packer fans, and I don't usually feel bad for them because they wear the cheese on their heads and they own their own team, and they seem like a happy lot. But watching that game last night, I was like, that's a terrible team to pin your hopes to.
Yeah, too bad.
Oh, yeah. But Seattle controls its own destiny.
It does now?
Yeah.
So if they win out, they're headed for the playoffs.
Yeah.
Really?
They win their final five games, they're going bowl. They're going. No,
how hard could that be?
And four out of the final five are at home.
That's correct.
Ooh.
Now they have three that they should win. Mm-hmm. Two against San Francisco, including this week when Richard Sherman returns to CenturyLink Field, and one against Arizona. They should win those. They have a home game against Minnesota that's probably shaping up to be the most important of their remaining five games, and then a game against Kansas City on December 23rd, where they're probably not going to be favored to win, given how highly scoring Kansas City is.
What's their record now, Kansas City?
Kansas City's lost twice.
Oh, twice.
Yes. They're coming off. They got a bye this week because they were supposed to play in Mexico last week, but they played in Los Angeles.
Well, they could have peaked then. They could be tanking that.
Sure. Or they could have everything all wrapped up in the AFC and they're not playing for anything at that point. That's also possible.
Whatever it takes.
If they win those three out of five, they what? Make the playoffs or get the wild card?
Probably make the playoffs and win. Okay. They're going to get the wild card. They will not win the division. If they win the three games, they should.
They're guaranteed a wild card?
If they win five.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, if they win five, they're guaranteed a wild card. They don't really have a chance of winning the division. That's pretty much out of it. If they win those three, they should. Two against San Francisco, one against Arizona. I think it's 85% chance that they get into this.
That means five must-win games, though. I don't know if I can stand the tension.
Really?
It's a lot.
Yeah. Buckle up. Gird your loins.
Gird your loins.
We talked about this.
Stay away from my loins.
Yeah, just gird them.
Last time I girded them, we lost. Them.
Really?
Yeah.
When was that?
I stopped girding them ever since.
that's not the moral you're supposed to take from that story. When you lose, you're not supposed to ungird your loins.
I see.
Maybe it'll work this way.
That's just uncomfortable for everybody, Dave.
Well, anyway, just congratulations to them. I thought it was
a great game.
It was fantastic.
And what was that? Who did that whole flip Spider-Man thing?
Dude, Chris Carson.
Woo! He stuck the landing.
He did.
The Mary Lou
three limbs.
Running back.
He was holding the ball and landed on three limbs after being flipped in the air.
He also said he's done with trying to jump people, which I can understand, man.
All the refs held up a 10.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Kerry Strunk's got nothing on me.
Wow. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
Gird your loins.
This is Seattle's Morning News. You probably know that a lot of people use what are called CPAP machines, continuous positive air pressure. It's basically a sleep mask that's designed to treat sleep apnea and, probably even more than that, the loud snoring that gets people kicked out of the bedroom. It turns out that the newer CPAP machines are spying on you. ProPublica has looked into this, and reporter Marshall Allen is going to tell us what's going on. So they're collecting data, right, Marshall?
The machines have collected data for a long time, but it's just that the data used to be collected on those little SD cards, and then the patient would take the data to their doctor, and then the doctor could see how well the treatment was helping the patient. But the newer models of the machine have a wireless modem attached, and what that modem does is it transmits that data. Often it will go directly to the company that made the machines, and then that company will give access to the data to the supply company and also to the insurance company. And the insurance company is then doing it. They're basically surveilling the patients to measure their compliance with the device. I mean, these are, you know, pretty cumbersome things to use. It takes quite a lifestyle change to get accustomed to using it. Yeah. So about a third of patients don't comply with the machine or don't do it enough hours. And so then the insurance company will refuse to reimburse for it.
And the only way you find out about that is when you try to buy an accessory and you're turned down and they say, by the way, Mr. Allen, you only used it for 3 hours last Thursday night, which kind of creeps people out.
Well, it's pretty creepy, and a lot of patients don't realize that this is happening. I mean, whether they know it or not, they've given consent when they agree to obtain the device and when their doctor prescribes it. That is considered the consent that they gave to let the insurance company monitor them. And they're supposed to be told about this. So, you know, it doesn't always happen that way, and patients don't always understand exactly what's going on. And then the bigger issue is privacy experts are very concerned about this because there is no real restriction on an insurance company using that data for other purposes once it's in their hands. So you can imagine an insurance company is trying to measure how much you might cost them. If they had data on how many hours a night you slept or how many times your sleep was interrupted, or even the fact that you're using a CPAP machine at all, well, that's something that they can use to rate you as a higher risk and to also increase the cost of care that you pay because they would consider you a higher health risk.
Now, is this a legal loophole that insurance companies have been able to find? It just does not feel sniff test wise legal to be able to deny somebody that for some is a life-saving machine because they're not using it enough hours on Thursday night.
Well, it doesn't feel right, you know, but it is legal.
Wow.
And it's not something that the law prohibits. And so I think that's really the broader point of this story. This story is really showing how even if you're insured, the insurance companies are finding all types of sneaky ways to pass the cost of care on to you. And so with the surveillance, they are trying to find people who are not compliant so they can refuse to pay for the machine. But I also looked at the rental fees that they're charging. So a lot of insurance companies will have a mandatory rental period for the machines. And they say they do that because they want to make sure it's the right therapy for you. They want to make sure you're compliant with the use of the machine. But these rental agreements sometimes will end up costing way more for the patient than they would have paid just if they didn't use their insurance and paid cash for the machine. So, for example, I talked to one patient named Alan Levy. He's an attorney in New Jersey. And Alan's insurance company required him to pay about $100 a month for 15 months to rent the machine. So that's about $1,500. Well, the catch is the machine was only worth about $500. And so Alan happens to be an attorney, so he really knew exactly what to do. He ended up suing the insurance company, actually the supply company, under the consumer fraud law in New Jersey. And as soon as he filed that lawsuit, they came to him and they settled and they let him pay cash for the machine. He was in a high deductible plan. You know, a lot of patients these days have to pay the first $1,000 or $2,000 before the insurance coverage even kicks in. So these rental policies, when they're charging you more than the machine is worth, that can become a moneymaker for the insurance company, believe it or not.
You can buy these machines with cash, but you can't buy them unless you have a prescription, correct?
That's correct. You need a prescription, but you can buy them in cash. And typically, you know, they're around $500 up to, say, $800, depending on, you know, the bells and whistles.
Now, let me ask you this. Is the data collection absolutely necessary, or do you think the primary reason for it is to be able to up people's premiums?
Well, yeah. So as you and I talked about, one of my previous stories was about how the insurance industry is teaming up with the data broker industry to build profiles on all of us. And so United Healthcare, for instance, has a profile on hundreds of millions of Americans. So there's a good chance the people listening to us right now, including the three of us, have a profile in this on the servers of United Healthcare. And so they can use that information to rate how much they predict that we will cost, and they can use that information to raise our rates. I mean, in a lot of cases, that is possible to do, even under the Affordable Care Act.
Are we aware of any other machines that are being used in this manner? And just full disclosure, because I'm racking my brain thinking, what else could be out there other than these CPAPs? And I'm thinking, breast pumps. I remember renting one, my insurance paying for part of it, hospital grade. Okay, what if they start tracking, am I pumping enough breast milk to justify them paying for this device? So any other devices out there doing this?
You know what? I had not even thought about the breast pumps, but that's a great example, and you're actually thinking the right way. We happened to look at some other common devices. We looked at CPAP units,
heart monitors and different lifestyle apps like Fitbits and Apple Watches. And we found that each of those types of devices are gathering data and using it in ways that patients might not realize. And so in some cases, you know, with a patient's consent, the data can be shared with an insurance company. And it's really hard for us to know exactly how the insurance company is using that data, but they are incentivized to gather the data on each of us because they're building these profiles of us. And this is data that once it's on their servers, it can be used in a lot of different ways that we don't even know about. But we did do an accompanying story to this one about the CPAP machines that's called Your Medical Devices Are Not Keeping Your Health Data to Themselves.
All right, Marshall, thank you for waking us up to this. You can find all of Marshall Allen's work at ProPublica.org. Marshall, thanks.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks, Colleen.
Thank you. Slow jam it.
Yeah.
Slow jam the news.
When Initiative 1639, just approved by voters, goes into effect, you can be charged with a crime if your firearm ends up in the wrong hands. That has a lot of gun owners asking about their options, and so Cairo's Heather Bosch checked out a gun safe store.
Gun safes come in different shapes and sizes, everything from a briefcase-like box to a large bank-like vault.
This is 36 wide by 25 deep, and then it's 59 inches tall.
So Zach Boyer, co-owner of Tracker Safe, says consider what you're buying the safe for. A larger safe can protect a collection of long guns you might hunt with or collect, while a smaller safe bolted near your bed might be right for a single gun used for home protection. Now, there are several options for opening your gun safe.
There's the traditional dial combination.
Pretty basic.
But it's not like your high school locker or like a padlock. It's a UL-listed dial lock that is very secure.
You spin the dial on the front of the safe to specific numbers.
Four times to the left and just stop right on your first number.
Enter the correct combination.
That's when you know you've done it right.
Okay, that's very secure, but it does take time to open. For quicker access, Boyer says many customers choose safes with biometric technology. They can open with the touch of a finger.
So it scans your fingerprint, you register your fingerprint into the safe, and it's electronic, obviously, runs on batteries.
And other members of the family can use it because you can program it to recognize more than one finger. However, the technology is not perfect. Even slight alterations to your fingerprint from a cut to aging skin can prevent the safe from reading your print. But there's another option.
And then you have your traditional electronic lock, so your push button.
Think of it like unlocking your cell phone.
And those are also UL listed, and they have their security ratings on them as well.
As for rapid access,
the safe right here has a spring-loaded front door, so as soon as the code's entered, the door opens up.
That's pretty fast. Safes come at varying price points, too, about $30 for the most basic to thousands for the larger, more elaborate models. Bottom line, just as you check out a gun to determine what's the most practical and comfortable for you to use, you want to put that same amount of thought into what gun storage option works best for you.
Heather Bosch, that's assuming you remember the code in the heat of the moment. So, Hannah, I'm surrounded by gun owners here. So, what is it for you, Hannah?
We have a lockbox with our guns in it. It's a four-digit push-button code that I keep in my closet.
And you trust that?
I do. And also, if I need to, and I believe 1639 also allows for this, if for some reason I'm feeling concerned, I will keep it in my drawer under my pillow, and that is allowed.
Probably go with the biometric option. That one to me seems the quickest because, you know, and I've shared this story before, we've done the trigger lock for, you know, many, many years with the three-digit code that you slide and then it comes off. But when I was home alone and there was an attempted home break-in, my brain was so scrambled from fright that I couldn't remember the code to unlock the trigger lock. So I thought, well, that's not helpful to me in this situation. So for me, a safe with just a quick biometrics. But as you find out with the iPhone, if you're sweaty at all while you're sleeping,
they're glitchy. That's the problem.
So, so I suppose Heather's advice is great. Go test it out. Maybe submerge your hand in water and see.
Yeah.
It's all too complicated.
I just
have a minefield in my lawn.